week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together and talk about politics and current events. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Kinnig.
Brandon, it feels like it's been 6 months since we did a podcast.
It does. It's been a long time. I think it's been between 3 and 4 weeks, and we've had disruptions of vacations on both our parts, yep. Sickness, illness, yep. Work interfering. So it's been a combination of all that. And it's interesting how things come in threes, right? So I was on vacation, you were on vacation, then, you know, I get back from vacation, then you get sick, and yeah. then, you know, it's just, it balloons.
So last week I had to blow off the podcast because I thought I had COVID. I've been doing some work on a house that a friend and I bought, and we're trying to flip the house. So we've got a general contractor, and I'm doing some general work, and we were busting up an old brick wall, and I basically stepped on a shard of brick that went through my shoe and into my foot. So this happens last Monday. So I'm thinking, oh, this sucks. My foot hurts. I'm going to have a bruise on my foot, a little cut. No big deal. So I get up Tuesday and just feel awful. And my daughter, who was home for the weekend, she called Tuesday morning. She tested positive for COVID. Most of the people that I'm working with around this house, they all have had COVID in the past 2 or 3 weeks. So logically, I thought I had COVID. So I went and got an over-the-counter COVID test that came back negative. Long story short, went to the doctor. Basically, the doctor said they called it serum sickness. I don't know if that's the word for it, but basically I got a bacterial infection from the brick that I stepped on.
Ugh, and those are rough.
Yeah. So I spent 4 days. I'll just put it this way. Wednesday night, I had to get out of bed twice and towel off. I was sweating so bad. I basically had to shower in the middle of the night and change the sheets on the bed because I was sweating so bad. So that's when it's like, okay, maybe this isn't COVID. And the doctor's like, yeah, you probably have a bacterial infection come from stepping on that. So again, antibiotics, tetanus shot, all of that stuff.
So you've probably been on some pretty strong antibiotics.
It has literally taken me a week and a half just to get to this point where we're recording this at like 6 o'clock that I can make it through a day and basically still be standing. So it's been a rough week and a half from a health perspective. So
yeah, sorry to hear that. Glad you're on the mend though.
And I am. I think the lesson here is if you're going to play construction worker, wear some decent shoes.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, that just, that sounds painful just hearing you describe how it happened.
Remember what's the movie, The Quiet Place?
Yeah.
Is it in one or two where Emily Blunt steps on the nail?
Yes. On the staircase. Yes.
I closed my eyes when that scene came on. I'll never be able to look at that again. Cause that just, there's no way somebody could have kept quiet. Even if their life was in jeopardy.
How loud did you scream or yell out when this happened?
Well, I stepped back into it.
Oh, okay.
So here came I yelled immediately. And again, my fault. I was doing demolition style work and just didn't have the right kind of shoes on.
Yeah.
So my fault, but it's one of those things where you just don't think about it. It's like, ah, shit, that'll hurt. And the doctor's like, where it is and in the ball of your foot is a combination of multiple bones. She's like, your foot's going to hurt for months. There's just no way around it. And I don't know when's the last time if you had like a sprained ankle or a sprained foot, there's just no way to let it heal.
Yeah.
Unless you can sit for weeks and do nothing. She's like, yeah, it's just going to hurt. You're going to hobble around for a couple months, it'll eventually go away. So that's my sad story to why we missed podcasting last week, which was my fault.
Yeah, you're right though. I mean, foot and leg injuries just take such a long time to heal.
At least you missed for good reasons. You're out of town.
Yeah.
You get a travel opportunity. You're
Southern
in California,
which is always
like
good.
That.
Yeah. So I no complaints on my end. So it's been nice.
One time, Brandon, I think you're gonna find yourself at the airport and just say, I can't do it.
Not coming back.
I'm just staying.
That's probably going to be on a day like in like the just bleak winter month of January where it's like a blizzard here and it's take 2 degrees and yeah. I'm in California. I'm thinking, do I really want to come back? Maybe I need to change my plans.
So we haven't talked for like a month about politics. And in this news cycle, it's impossible to recap what's happened in the last 30 days.
Yes. So I don't even know where you would start. If the last 30 days would be like recapping almost an entire year in pre, you know, 2000s era where we are now.
Let me ask you this. Just how do you feel about how the government is functioning right now? If you had to put a grade on it or a percentage, you know, 100% is fully functional. Just where are you with with looking at the American government, the Biden administration, what's happening? Just give me your general thoughts with where you are right now.
I'd probably put an F on it for failure at all levels. And it's frustrating too, because I want the administration to succeed. I want Biden's government to succeed. I think it's incumbent for all of us that they be able to succeed. But then there's been some self-inflicted wounds on their part and just lack of coherent strategy on many policy fronts, which is also frustrating. And, you know, I don't know. Now, you know, it's interesting because you can take any number of issues, COVID, but say, for example, the roadblock, transients with the infrastructure bill and the social spending bill. So there's been a lot, you know, typically presidents get criticism for not being directly involved in doing enough to get their policy initiatives across the finish line. But in this case, it really makes me wonder, Biden's entire presidency, the possibility of Republicans taking both houses, all of that depends on this passing.
On his performance.
And his performance. And so he needs to be even more mindful of that than he may have been as VP in the Obama administration. You know, we had polarization then, but it's 1,000 times worse now. And granted, we can't afford to have the government come to a standstill, because the difference between now and then is we have one party right now that is committed to anti-democratic activity as well, which is a problem. So he needs to be doing everything possible. And I can't understand. We've gone through weeks upon weeks now where we're no closer to passing a bill than we were before. And in fact, we see the public spat on a daily basis between the progressive wing and the moderate wing. And we can't seem to find a compromise that'll work for Sinema and Manchin, who are the two kingmakers when it comes to something passing the Senate. And I know that Biden has met with them directly a number of times individually. I know the speaker Pelosi has, and she's very bright and adept. So I'm just trying to figure out what is going on here? Why are we still stuck?
Let me ask this. It's been weeks that this has been debated. Do you know anything more about this bill than you did 3 weeks ago?
I didn't.
I don't either.
I don't. And I don't know. Part of the frustration I have is that you have progressives that feel like, you know, $2 billion, $1.5 and $2 billion. Trillion.
Let me correct myself. We've graduated to the T, not the B.
That $1.5 to $2 trillion is not enough, and that would be a failure. And I'm thinking, these are huge numbers. You had David Axelrod, who, you know, strategist for President Obama, who said, you know, call me old fashioned, or I don't know when the party left me, but, you know, it wasn't that long ago we would have been thinking, this is amazing. We can't believe we're at the point of being able to pass something of this scope and size.
If $2 trillion doesn't cut it, why?
Yeah.
Why won't it cut it? What gets left out if it goes from 3.5 to 2? I haven't heard anything about that. And this bill is a grab bag of everything.
Everything.
Because that's just how we do legislation these days.
We throw it all together.
That's how we do it.
It's not smart. And then it it comes back to bite us. And it also contributes to Americans' distrust in government and just overall cynicism, because inevitably things get passed that are pretty awful. And the excuse is, well, you know, it was all in the bill. It was either vote for it or don't vote for it. And the problem is, if you don't vote for it, you're not able to vote for the good things. And so it's a very cynical way to get things across the finish line that wouldn't be able to get passed on their own.
And I think that the Republicans are framing this as a complete cradle to grave realignment of how the federal government interacts with individual citizens. That sounds a bit hyperbolic.
Well, and it is. I mean, to some degree,
because there is a lot in this bill.
There is. I mean, every big spending bill is framed that way by the Republican side. But I think the crux of the matter is that it's just extremely asinine to me that you would have progressives that are willing to just torpedo this entirely and risk not passing anything because they want more trillions, because $1.5 to $2 trillion isn't enough. And so their response is, and we're not going to pass anything, when again, there should be the idea that it's incumbent to pass an infrastructure bill. We haven't had an infrastructure bill in this country in well over 20 years. We're in dire need of one. If that alone was the only thing that came out of this and the numbers are there for it, that would be a huge, and can't be overstated enough, significant win for the Biden administration, that they could put that feather in their cap, go to the midterms and be able to campaign on. And that would be the second major win after the COVID pandemic bill. So to risk all that, I mean, if we really get to the point that nothing gets passed because they literally can't come together and compromise. And again, the Republicans are staying out of this process just as they are on the debt and budget negotiations, which is another area that is extremely frustrating because we allow ourselves to get to this brink where the full faith and credit of the United States is tested and where we are about to, you know, put a shock to the economy only to come back to the brink. I mean, that does nothing to reassure our allies. No. It makes us look like we're just completely incompetent. And yet we continue to do that over and over again.
Well, what I don't get is, so you have the progressive wing of Democrats who say, oh my God, anything less than 3.5 trillion isn't big enough and doesn't give us what we want, but they can't explain why $2 trillion won't cover it. Then you have Joe
Manchin. What is essential that we would not have with that extra one and have to, I mean, if the fact that they haven't said it yet makes me think that it's not essential. It's dispensable.
And then you have Joe Manchin who says, well, 3.5 trillion is way too much. Why?
Yeah.
He can't explain that number either, except it's a big number and it scares the shit out of people in West Virginia.
Right.
Which I don't, this bill represents the worst part of how we're passing legislation right now. Like you said, dump everything into a bill. So there's no possible way you can segment out. This is essential. This is a must have. This is a nice to have. This is what I'm willing to negotiate on. You take it all or you take nothing. Basically what it means, the only vote is a party line vote because you're not voting for a specific thing. You're just voting for what the party basically wants at this point.
Yeah. And that's essentially what these deliberations and machinations behind the scene are about, because, you know, there isn't any Republican support for a larger bill that contains any social service spending or anything of that nature. So that whole debate is happening within the Democratic Party itself and the different factions.
Let's talk historically. And so let me ask this way. Is it smart for the Democrats to pass the largest social spending bill ever constructed, and one that will in significant ways change the way the federal government interacts with almost everybody in the United States, and not have one single Republican vote? Should that happen? Not can it, because we know it can. Should it?
I mean, I don't think it should. And I think that if you're going to expend political capital on something that's super far reaching, that's going to have that type of effect and not be able to get a single Republican vote, do it on something like, you know, codifying voting rights at the federal level or something that's going to impact future elections or just strengthen the ability of local election officials to insulate them from abuse at the state level by, you know, runaway state lawmakers, something of that nature. But why you would do it on social spending and social services of all things, when again, I mean, you could easily do that and then lose both majorities. And, you know, what's to say that Republicans won't come down the line and just reverse that with the same way that you pass that in the first place?
Let me ask it a different way. Is it asinine that no Republican is even talking about this, that this has no Republican support, where in states, definitely southern states, they need this? They need some of this desperately. Is it equally ridiculous that Republicans won't even engage in the conversation?
Well, I think it is. But I think part of the problem is Republicans have a buffer. I think they're able to not talk about some of the items, spending items in this bill, because they're able to just point to the price tag and they can use that as a shield and say, you know, I can't, we can't even start debate on this because it's just too high. And so I think that gives them cover when it necessarily shouldn't. And that's why that's another reason I think that we should negotiate down or have, or just be able to start out and say, hey, it's all on the table in terms of the total cost and let's work backwards. Because at least if you do that, you put Republicans on the defense.
Yeah.
And you have to get them to say, well, what are you actually for or against in the bill? because all of the focus is then off of the price tag itself to on what's actually in the bill, like you said.
Well, the easiest thing to do here would have been to put full funding of a border wall or barrier into this bill.
Oh, that'll always gain Republican support. Yeah, I mean,
this is the triangulation. This is where I'm going
to. Why does nobody do that anymore? What happened to the Bill Clinton, Tony Blair '90s triangulation?
Does anybody care?
Politician.
Let me ask this. What bill would Republicans vote for? And we don't have to get specific. Just in overall, what category of bills would the Republican Party vote for right now? Something that lowers taxes or changes tax code. Yeah. They'll do that. Criminal justice stuff. Military. The point I'm making is the Republicans come nowhere near this because they want no part of passing any type of social safety laws. And anything that changes or enhances the federal government's power, while they will benefit from that and they will take the full benefit of it, they will not vote in support of anything like that. I guess the thing I keep rolling over in my head over and over is the Republicans don't want to govern and the Democrats just absolutely suck at it.
Yeah.
And that's going to be your choice moving forward. Do you want to vote for the Republicans who will sit on their hands and do nothing? Or do you want to vote for the Democrats who always try to overshoot the moon and end up getting nothing done?
Well, not only are Republicans not doing nothing, they're willing to take us to the brink of economic calamity, when it comes to the budget and the debt crisis and raising the debt ceiling. So you have to weigh that in. And that, again, that's why there's no margin for error on the Democratic side. And so it's interesting because there's a lot of former Republicans, anti-Trump Republicans out there that are all trying to give Democrats advice. And the reason that all of us are doing this is because the Democrats have to be successful. There's no margin for error. If the Democrats are not smart and are not strategic and fumble their way through this, they can't risk or afford to have the other party take power because we have another party that has no interest in governing and also has some authoritarian tendencies and is willing to roll back democracy.
But the Democrats up the debt limit under Trump every time. This wasn't an issue when the Democrats were
exactly
power,
and that's
because they know this is just a part of a functioning government. And
it's
we're not
a responsible adult
correct.
Thing to do. Yes.
We're not spending new money. We're just authorizing the spending of stuff we've already passed.
And again, and as Republicans raise the debt ceiling, what, twice at least during the Trump era?
At least twice.
So, and now they're not, it's a complete political play. Again, McConnell's burn down the House strategy, burn it all down, because his tactic, and he knows it's irresponsible, he knows it's dangerous, he doesn't care, because it's all about the political calculus. If Republicans can have nothing to do with it and stay out of it, they can and basically cast total blame on the Democrats. The Democrats can own it. They can use it as an election issue. So that's the idea. And the idea is to do that for everything, not just the debt ceiling, by the way. So it's trying to ensure that Biden is not able to peel any Republicans off for any of these major initiatives.
And didn't the Democrats already raise the debt ceiling for 3 weeks?
They
passed some temporary
budget measure that funded the budget through what was it the end of the year, but that measure ensured we didn't have a shutdown a week or two ago whenever that happened.
So what are we arguing about? I've lost the thread on almost all political topics I'm trying to follow. Well, if the Democrats can do it through reconciliation, which they can, why don't they just do it?
I don't understand why. Because from the estimates that I've heard that come out of and I forget which agency this came out of, but October 18th was a date that we would technically run out of money and wouldn't be able to fulfill our obligations. And that's when we would start to see markets tank and all of the
repercussions. And they did a 3-week extension.
Yeah.
Why
around with this? Use reconciliation then. Bring everybody back and just have at it.
I don't understand that. Why can't somebody come out? I was going to say Chuck Schumer, but nobody, and that's the problem. There's nobody believable enough or that nobody wants to listen to, and just say the Republicans are children. This is an artificial fight. We're just going to do it. Move on.
Yeah. That's what they should say. And I don't understand if they just did that. I mean, they could still use that issue against Republicans. Why not hammer that issue? Now, again, it would depend upon them having the discipline and the attention span to really like focus on a message and stay on that message. And Democrats fail to do that over and over again. They don't stick to message. Yeah.
And somebody with credibility to lay it out there too.
You need that person too, someone with credibility. And the question is who that would be, but it's possible. And again, they don't have to be on defense on this. I mean, they could be on offense.
I'm pretty sure the finances of the United States of America are more complicated than you and I's personal finances.
Yeah.
But it's always couched with, oh my God, you guys can't run up debt. The government shouldn't. I don't know how debt and the government works. I do know that the US dollar is basically the foundation for the world economy.
It is.
And because of that, it allows us to do things with debt that other countries can't do.
Yeah.
Are we carrying too much debt? It feels like it.
We probably are. Yeah.
We probably are. Can we take on more debt? Maybe. I don't know. And how do you ever get to know these things? Who can explain this? Because Republicans simply do not give a shit about this issue. They use it against the Democrats when it suits them. When Trump came in, one thing I like about Trump, don't care about the debt, don't care, don't talk about it, don't give a shit, not going to be here.
Yeah.
We're moving on. I just wish we could gain some type of consistency around how we talk about the debt. And there was some way that we could help understand what is a realistic level of debt that we should carry. Because what are we like, 11, 12 trillion, 30 trillion in debt or something? It's some unimaginable number. What does that mean? And who can explain that to us?
In real terms, yeah.
What does it mean, like I said, in real terms? What does our debt prevent us from doing? I don't know. I can't think of a single thing that we wanted to do that somebody said, oh, debt's too high. Can't do it.
Well, and we are protected to some degree, insulated from foreign criticism, because like you said, the US dollar is the global standard currency standard. And because of that, we get a lot of leeway that we otherwise wouldn't have when it comes to our debt and raising the debt ceiling. Because the other thing too, is all of these other countries that depend on us, they can't afford for the dollar to collapse.
No.
Because then it becomes a domino effect and it will cause those other global economies to collapse as well.
The world will prop up the dollar for its own interest if that's what it comes to.
Right. And the alternative, if that were to ever happen, who would likely benefit from that? China. Right? I mean, China for years has actually wanted to reverse that trend and to not have the US dollar be the global standard anymore. And they would be the one to come in and swoop in and benefit from such a crisis.
So the Democrats are going to get something passed. They have to. Like you said, they've got the traditional infrastructure bill that 19 Republican senators voted on just sitting there.
Right.
That has to get through, right?
I think so. Yes, that has to get signed. And I can't imagine. I mean, if we were to have some type of scenario where that doesn't get passed because of progressive gripes about the larger spending bill.
Shut it down.
No, that's complete incompetence. Yeah. And almost the Democrats don't deserve to win re-election.
If we don't get that bill passed, we lose 50 seats in the House.
Yeah.
And we lose in the Senate.
Lose the Senate.
Because what's the point?
And then the Biden administration's agenda becomes dead on arrival.
Yeah. If we put the Democrats in office, well, number one, it wasn't the adults coming back.
Yeah.
Because nothing has fit that bill since they've been through. They've screwed up multiple. I would say the communication about things hasn't really greatly improved since Trump was there. If this is what we're going to get, bring the Trump show back. At least there's something to talk about and it's entertaining. This was the Democrats' biggest moment to show what can happen when the adults run the federal government and there's an interest in the federal government being active and a positive force in people's lives. If they can't pull this off, it undercuts their entire message. And I don't know where they pivot to get back on solid footing if they don't get this
done. I don't either. And it's, they have to deliver. There's no questions about it. They just have to. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They can't, you know, run out the clock. Like, it's do this or you don't get reelected. I mean, it's just, that's where we are.
Now, Kristen Sinema got harassed taking a pee at ASU over her stance, I guess, or lack of stance, or I don't know what she thinks about the Build Back Better agenda. What's your thoughts on that? I think there's a little pearl clutching going on.
Well, see, and I think we differ about this a little bit. I am all for confronting politicians in public spaces, especially politicians who are not transparent, who do not readily answer questions or make themselves available by all means. But I do think that has its limits too. So I do cringe when I see people walking with video cameras into restrooms and following and harassing politicians there, or like walking up to them as they're seated on a plane with a camera in their face. Like, I feel like there's a time and purpose for that. If they're in a public airport in a terminal right there, great. Then yeah, do it, because that's, but there should be some things off limits. And my concern is, and I understand the frustration with Kyrsten Sinema, because she does not speak to the press. She revels in being able to be unpredictable.
This is her game.
And she's been referred to as an enigma, and she likes that. And I get that she's trying to craft this maverick image, but so I understand that frustration. But I also feel like if these activists who are trying to get answers from her take it too far, it's going to be counterproductive. I mean, who's to say she doesn't just retaliate at the very end and just completely decide to come out against everything? Because we have to think, I mean, she's human as well, and she could act in ways that are very human. React, I should say.
There's that phrase, I can wave my fist around all I want. Until I hit somebody with it, I've done no harm. It, does that still, I guess that phrase was invented before cell phones and everybody had a video camera in their pocket and all of that. But I guess I look at this, you mentioned that this is part of Sinema's stick. She has played this enigmatic, not telling you anything role since she got to the Senate.
Yes.
I personally am tired of it. As a U.S. Senator, you owe everybody an explanation of where you stand, why you stand, and what you want to see. Joe Manchin has done this. Sometimes it's worked out to his favor. Other times he's pissed people off and made the problem worse. But to have no answer on this, right, I find that wholly
unacceptable. But Manchin, even when he's not clear, he at least speaks to the press. He'll answer questions. Yeah. Like, Sinema does not do press interviews. She does not go on television. She does not speak to reporters. Like,
she's a U.S. senator. It comes with the job.
And I think a lot of, you know, a lot of progressive activists, like, I'll listen to some of the podcasts on the left and to what they're saying online, and they have frustrations and will grumble about both. There seems to be a little bit more understanding with Manchin because he hails from West Virginia, which went for Trump by 68%. That's not the case with Arizona. Arizona isn't a blue state, but it is a purple state. And and nobody even slightly to the left of Manchin could be elected in West Virginia.
Correct.
But in Arizona, Sinema has a fellow senator who was just elected. Mark Kelly, who isn't like this at all, and you know, and is still relatively moderate and maintains his image, but he doesn't play this game. So it's not something that has to be done either. No. And it's not,
all Sinema's doing is guarantee she gets primaried.
Oh, and I think without a doubt she will. And so it'll be,
I think she's going to lose that primary. I think there's a lot of people really pissed at her, and she's done this to herself.
Yeah.
Which, if this is what she wants to do, cool. Why? Why do this? Why give the curtsy when you shit on the $15 minimum wage bill?
Right.
What?
But see, and
for whom is she performing is my question.
Correct. And it's interesting because I think, I mean, she has made the reference a lot of times. She admires John McCain and wants to kind of fill that role of a John McCain style maverick.
John McCain had a gravitas behind him that he could get away with that. Kyrsten Sinema wears cute outfits.
Yes.
They're not the same.
And John McCain didn't do these political theater on the floor
did.
Like, I mean, that's the difference. And I think John McCain was actually known for talking to the press all the time. He was always out there doing interviews. I mean, the press loved John McCain.
And
because
he was fair with the press.
Yeah.
I mean, there's stories where he would yell at somebody, then write them a letter saying, sorry about that. I'll do better next time.
He always made himself accessible. So he was a maverick, but again, he made it transparent where he stood on issues. And so if people didn't like or support him, it wasn't because they didn't know where he stood. And that's the difference with Sinema, is she likes playing this game and keeping people guessing and having it be a mystery. I mean, it really feels like she just enjoys that.
Kristen Sinema is going to fart around. She's going to get primaried and she's going to lose. And when she does, it's all her fault.
You know, the interesting thing is, if you follow Sinema's career, like if when she started off as a state lawmaker in Arizona, when she first got started in politics, she was a Green Party activist. She was on the far left of the party and just moved to the center over the course of her career. And, you know, now it's interesting because I think she's tried to make some type of long-term strategical move that would get her national prominence. But again, she's risking
by shitting on this.
Well, and that's the thing,
this
right?
This is her calculation.
All of that, I think, goes by the wayside if she can't get reelected in her own party.
Shitting on your party's signature policy.
Not going to do it.
And not explaining why.
Right.
I don't understand how that leads you up the pole.
Yeah.
I don't get that. So you said you tried to listen to some progressive podcasts. All progressive podcasts suck, don't they? They're terrible. They're awful.
They are. I mean, most of them are. There's maybe one that I like. And I'll always go back to some that I listen to. And then it just drives me crazy.
They're humorless.
Yeah, they're humorless. And they... to me, some of them come across as preachy and just condescending and almost like, again, in this like bubble, right? This type of silo where like, we can't believe this is happening or how could this be the case?
They're always shocked at something that's extremely obvious to everybody else. I was like, I can't believe that didn't happen. Really?
And I can only deal with that so long before I get frustrated and turn it off.
I listened to a couple. I listened to Jimmy Dore. He's a progressive, but he's got some comedy elements to it.
Okay.
I've tried to listen to Rumble with like Michael Moore and it's just not entertaining enough.
No.
It's all sad and grouchy. And
now one podcast I really liked that I got into recently was Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy. And it's a little bit different. It's not a progressive one because you have somebody on the right and the left. And so I appreciate that more because I think you get more out of something where you have that type of exchange of ideas or there's a little bit more intellectual diversity. But I can't. I'll listen to like the Pod Save America guys every once in a while.
Occasionally.
But then I get frustrated with them and then I'll stop. And
there's just no recognition among those guys that half the country doesn't think like you.
No, they don't seem to get it at all.
California. And they're shocked.
And they all live in California.
I know.
So they're all of that mindset. Yeah.
So for any progressive liberal out there that could hear me, the podcast that I listen to, the McCarthy Report with Andrew McCarthy.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is a podcast with no production value. It's Rich Lowry and Andrew McCarthy. They have no personality about them. There's no production value to it. They record it like over Zoom, but it's invaluable because Andrew McCarthy, who I disagree with politically almost everything, in his DNA, he's a lawyer. And for legal questions, he will just tell you. He plays it as straight down the middle as anybody I've ever heard. Like when the Trump and all that, the bullshit after his election, it was invaluable because you could cut through everything that was being said and you knew McCarthy was being straight with you. And trying to find sources of information like that, they're out there, but you're right. If you're looking for them on the progressive side, you got to dig to find it.
You do, yeah.
And then when you do find one, it's usually so obnoxious, you don't want to listen to it anyway.
That's a challenge, yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why Rush Limbaugh was the biggest radio personality in the world.
Right. There's something to be said for that balance of like information, humor, lightheartedness with seriousness. And I mean, if you don't have that right mix, it goes downhill.
Limbaugh could be a grade A-hole, but he also tried to be funny at times. Now, you may not like his sense of humor, but he took that approach to it, which I think makes all the difference in the world. And progressive and liberals just can't seem to find how to incorporate that into their shtick.
No, they don't do it well. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole world just the political environment in the United States seems to, over the last 6 or 8 weeks, just gone to hell. It just seems like we're falling down these waterfalls each time. And you look around and say, okay, how are we going to get out of this? How is 2022 going to be the start of where we maybe pivot and get better politically? I don't think that's going to happen. It feels like we're in this cycle of, again, alternate parties switching complete power every 4 to 6 years or 2 to 4 years. That happens. These monster packages get passed. They get undone by the next time that the opposition party comes into power, and we just keep on this cycle. Give me some hope that we can break this and get back to maybe something that resembled how this is supposed to work. Smaller bills, more debate, more things passing. We're not even going to debate this bill. There are no public hearings on this bill.
No.
That's asinine.
So how are Americans supposed to know the details of what's in it?
It's a great point. I mean, when it's signed the bill, then we'll find out.
Yeah.
I heard that Alabama, I don't want to get my poor southern states mixed up. They're using the majority of their COVID funds from the federal government to build prisons. That's what they're doing with it. So now we're going to pump billions more to states for social programs that some of them are going to be hesitant. What are we doing?
I don't understand that. And I didn't realize that the COVID funds were that flexible, that you could use them for building prisons. Really?
This is Governor Ivey down there. She had a press conference.
Oh, Alabama.
In Alabama, where they had reallocated some funds that were made around improving ventilation and facilities. And they're like, we're just going to build some new prisons with this. Point being is, a lot of times when money gets into the wild, you don't exactly know where it's going or how it's being applied.
The strings that were attached are no longer there. Yeah.
What strings come with all this money? Are there any?
Well, and again, then we find ourselves in a situation that's ripe for abuse, like with the PPP loan, money that just went out to anybody and everybody, and there was no tracking of that or accounting.
I was listening to Representative Jayapal, I think is her name. She's kind of the head of the progressives.
From Washington State, yeah.
And there's a provision in this bill that everybody gets like a child tax credit. And the question was, well, shouldn't you means test that?
I saw this.
I mean,
segment,
there are people who don't need this. Nope. Nope. Too much paperwork. We're just going to do it.
And that just floored me. Like,
you could
really
cut billions off the price tag. Nope. We're just going to. Okay. So does that mean there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there it's crazy what they're doing.
And I think that's what frustrates people, right? Because then you're adding on this public benefit, and there is majority consensus that safety net items should go to people who need them, but then you're just going to be blanket, this is available to everybody. Oh, and that's why this costs, so many trillions of dollars, when you don't care to do the work that's necessary to make sure that the benefit only goes to those who need it. And you just, it takes too much time. And I saw this segment where she was like, well, we would need people to review that, and it takes so long. And like, but that's the point. That's why you have, people in those positions and in those auditing roles and those quality assurance roles, to make sure that that's there. Because if we're not going to have standards and everything's going to just be available to everybody, you can't control for costs at all. I mean, what?
Aren't they hiring 86,000 IRS agents if this thing goes through?
Yeah, exactly. So what are
they going to do?
Right.
I just, one thing this bill is missing is some good old fashioned Trump branding. Because Trump was so dumb, he could only remember one or two things at a time, which is really genius. So one, if this were Trump's bill, it'd have a catchy name that everybody would be able to recite. And Trump would have picked out one or two things of this bill that he really liked. He would test it at some rallies, spitting it out, doing some feedback. And that's what he would focus on. And he would push this through, basically not on the totality of everything that would do, but because it does these two things that the base wants. Why can we not learn that basic branding and packaging
buzzwords?
Yeah. I just don't. Trump has proven anything that works. Why is this still a $3.5 trillion bill that we couldn't tell you what's the most popular aspect of this bill?
Democrats don't do buzzwords, Craig. I mean, they do, soliloquies, and, they will talk about everything for 20 minutes. And again, you got to think in buzzwords and sound bites for the American people.
Is it really true in this bill that any interaction, any financial transaction over $600 is going to be
viewable? That's another aspect. I forgot about that. Yeah.
I don't like that.
No.
That sounds bad.
Super unpopular and controversial. Yeah.
So are they going to start monitoring Venmo and Cash App transactions for over $600?
That's a good question.
And hitting you with some kind of bill?
It's almost like they would have to, right? I mean, how else would they?
I mean, I'm all for more tax collection and people paying more of what they're worth. But if they start doing stuff like that, that seems like that's going to be horribly unpopular.
I would think so.
And that's going to impact everybody.
Right.
I think the the Democrats are playing the card. Something had to be done. And we're the party that does things. And if you elect us, you may not like what we do, but at least we'll do something. Can you name anything the Republicans are willing to do? And I guess that's what we're going to ride with. We got nothing else. You had another topic you want to talk. I've already forgotten what our second topic was, because the first one, and I've just been in this haze with this and what are the Democrats doing? And I've been just so disappointed in how bad Biden's fucked up this summer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's common for a president first term. You have a rough first summer because you're dealing with a bunch of stuff and leftover issues from the last administration. They have absolutely bottomed themselves out over the summer.
Yeah. I mean, there's a, and I think just to piggyback onto that, I don't want to spend too much time on it because it's, it gets old, but COVID, where we are with COVID in the US,
yeah,
there actually has been some good news. The latest numbers show that over the past 4 weeks that COVID new infections are down and death counts are down. So we may be turning a point there. Vaccination rate is inching up again. And then Merck also released a new drug, which that'd actually treats COVID, which is crucial because there haven't been that many treatments once you catch COVID. Really, all that we've had is the remdesivir, yeah, and the steroids treatments. And so now we have this new drug from Merck, which actually cuts down hospitalizations by a fair amount.
And
so
that's just a pill you can buy at your local whatever.
Easily taken, yeah.
I saw a stat the other day. I saw this on Twitter today. I think it was David Frum who tweeted this out. He's in Spain. Spain has a population of over 50 million people. They have the same number of COVID deaths per day as the state of Missouri that has 6 million people.
Wow.
The difference is Spain has over 83% of their population vaccinated. Missouri has 48%.
There you go.
And we're going to remain at that level of death per day. And I don't know what the total number is, but whatever it is unnecessary.
No, completely.
Because
and I mean, there's been all these
refuse to get vaccinated.
So we are at 700,000 deaths now since the start of the pandemic. And there's about 200,000 excess deaths solely due to people not being vaccinated,
yeah,
that are due to the vaccines being out and available and people not taking advantage of them. That 700,000 has eclipsed the general number. Again, it's over 100 years ago, so it's an estimate, but it eclipses the number during the Spanish flu, 675,000 deaths. So we have surpassed, yeah, that now. And again, it's just completely unnecessary. There is one place too that's part of the United States that is doing very well and leads in vaccination rate. You know which place that is? It's not a state.
I don't. I was going to say like Rhode Island.
Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So they are sitting at like 91% vaccination rate, yep, and they don't have the levels of vaccine hesitancy. And a lot of people have commented on this. One of the big things that's different about Puerto Rico versus the mainland is the difference in political culture. They don't have the toxic two-party duopoly that we have here in the States, with talk radio being as loud and obnoxious as it is with just the influence of the political sphere. So that's one of the overriding differences, which would probably account for why they've acclimated so well to the vaccine, where many of our states have not.
I've not heard any stories like come out of New York of hospital shortages since they laid off or got rid of like 3% of hospital workers who refused to take the vaccine.
Right. No, I haven't either. I think that was the big boogeyman that, yeah, you know, the right was saying, oh, you're going to see these mass resignations and it's going to crunch hospitals, which ironically, you know, they were making these claims at a time when hospitals were already overloaded because of COVID patients, yeah, and not being able to provide other types of surgeries and outpatient services. But we haven't seen that. And in fact, you have states like New York that seem to be doing good now. California, which is doing very well. I mean, their counts continue to plummet.
Well, Delta burned through the state.
Yeah.
It's what COVID does. A 2 or 3 week, month long spike.
Right.
Once everybody
cyclical
gets
pattern,
it,
yeah,
goes away. And the northern states will start seeing more as people start coming back indoors for the winter.
That's what people have to realize. It's when we're talking about vaccination now, like it's all about preventing death and keeping the hospitals at reasonable capacity so they don't get overwhelmed. And that's by not being vaccinated. That's what you risk, is you risk filling up your hospitals, not having emergency services available for people who need it outside of COVID, which we've seen in a handful of states. There was one guy who needed to be life flighted to a hospital, and none of the ICUs had capacity. Yeah. And I think his family called over 40 across the South, different states, to get him finally able to get him somewhere. But there's so many stories like that that have happened over the course of the last couple of months.
So Andrew Wiggins, ex-KU basketball player, plays for the Golden State Warriors. Mm-hmm. Andrew Wiggins, for the upcoming 2021-22 season, is owed $14.8 million. Without the vaccine, he could not play his home games in California because they have mandated the vaccine.
Yeah.
After a couple weeks of press conferences and saying he didn't want to get the vaccine, he finally got vaccinated. And in his press conference where he talked about, you know, why he was so hesitant and what, why he finally got the vaccination, he talked about that he had an adverse reaction to some medication he took a couple years ago. And from there, he's been very sensitive to what he puts into his body. And his example was, well, I carry an EpiPen now because that experience scared me so much. Well, what's the first question he gets asked? Do you know what's in the EpiPen? No.
Yeah.
Your point again is what?
Right.
Why I bring up Andrew Wiggins, lots of bluster, lots of I won't. Then he had to make a decision about $14.8 million and
got
the vaccine.
Money speaks, yeah.
Where Kyrie Irving, who has made hundreds of millions of dollars throughout his career, plays for the Nets, he's probably going to retire because he doesn't want to take the vaccine. At least I respect Kyrie's hustle. If this is your hustle, if this is your narrative, if this is your game, play it out. Yeah. It's only going to cost you $150 million in earnings, right. But if you're willing to walk away from that, so be it.
Yeah.
Yeah. A professional athlete who team doctors do undescribable things to. Pro sports is full of, it has a big history of team doctors prescribing god-awful things to people, unsafe things to people to get them to play. For one of them to say, I'm worried about what I stick in my body.
The irony.
Makes no sense. Brandon, did you melt down when you couldn't get on Facebook for 7 hours yesterday?
I did not. I was fine, actually. It was funny because I heard from friends and others who were just livid about it, and it was a topic of conversation for several hours. So I think good next topic. So Facebook has an outage the day after this bombshell. Well, you know, blown up as kind of a bombshell interview, 60 Minutes interview with this whistleblower who was a product manager, I believe, at Facebook, and who, you know, now claims that Facebook's algorithm intentionally amplifies divisive and negative harmful content, and they know it, they've known it for a long time, and that they just feed into it and it drives their profit margins. So I don't think any of that is surprising, really. Essential takeaway was that the difference is Facebook will publicly say, we're fighting against this, we're doing this, you know, but behind the scenes, they know that they benefit from it. And, you know, that has resulted in them not moving aggressively to combat it. And that, you know, they don't have the number of auditors to...
It's not a priority.
It's not a priority.
Yeah. This is what I can't understand. Company refuses to take steps that would limit its profitability. I don't get what is the discussion.
Well, and I think, again, it all goes back. We have a tendency now, and the left and the right does this. The right was doing this most recently when people like Trump and others were deplatformed after January 6th, you know, wanting to treat Facebook as a public good or public, you know, rather than a private entity, saying, well, they're too big. They're more akin to a public entity. They shouldn't have protections that traditional telecom companies have. And then you sometimes see the left say the same thing, like when it comes to like amplification of negative content. And so it all goes back to this idea that Facebook and the big tech giants, even though they technically are private companies, they shouldn't be treated as such. They're really public entities. They're big monopolies, and we should either break them up or we need to regulate them.
And Facebook is a unique spot for conservative media. Conservative media does very, very well on Facebook.
It does, yeah.
If you look at Facebook's most popular pages, you're going to see stuff like Ben Shapiro.
Daily Caller,
Dan Bongino, and stuff right. like that. Conservative podcasts and conservative media has found what up to now has been a fairly friendly home with Facebook.
And much more so on Facebook than on other platforms like Twitter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so...
And the average age of your Facebook user is probably what, in its 40s, I'm guessing?
Now, yeah, it tends to be older now. And so the younger kids are more on like Snapchat
Instagram
and Instagram.
Or whatever the hell that is. So it feels like the basic argument is Democrats feel Facebook lets out too much information. Conservatives feel they don't let out enough.
Right.
And so now the fight is what is the form of regulation coming to Facebook and social media? And I think we both agree that regulation is coming in some way.
It is. So the question is how much and to what extent. And so I think one thing to watch out for, and a lot of it's going to be political theater this week. They're having these hearings on Capitol Hill.
Great.
You know, on regulation, you know, and they're interviewing this product manager. So who, the whistleblower. And so you can judge by the bluff and the performance.
Well, here's how you know this is all performance. They're couching this in concern over young women. No, really? Really? That's the angle you're going to play. They're couching this as Instagram is detrimental to the mental health for young women. Okay. That's what we're supposed to care
about. Oh, is that one of the political arguments?
That's the main thrust of this whistleblower, is how evil and how bad Instagram is for young women. That's her moral stance.
But that's
why blowing the whistle.
I mean, that's a tangent. I mean, it's not related to the whole core issue on amplifying
correct
negative political content, which is what this all started.
Because that nobody can agree on.
Yeah.
What is the political content? Who's amplifying it? What Facebook does is they basically are suppressing non-mainstream media sources.
Right.
If you take like the Daily Wire, which is Ben Shapiro's media company, one of their primary ways to distribute content is through Facebook. Facebook is knocking their content distribution down because it doesn't come from what they consider a valid, trusted source. So the argument there is, what is a valid, trusted source? Why is the legacy media, why is something from CNN being treated as more truthful as something from the Daily Wire, Daily Caller, Daily Beast?
So you're saying Facebook's doing that now? Because
their
argument has been
now.
That they haven't done that. Yeah. Okay.
For years, Facebook was the holdout to say, we're just a platform, we don't care. In the last year, Zuckerberg has started to bend to political pressure. And he's even come out and said, regulate us. Tell me the rules. I don't want to make them up. He went from, we're not going to be an arbiter of truth and we're not going to be a publisher, to just tell me the rules and we'll play by whatever you want if it gets you off my back. Because he knows it's coming anyway. He's trying to get out of it as much as he can. But the whole couching this whistleblowers, I'm doing this because, you know, my moral stance is how bad this is for young women. I don't think anybody's buying that.
No.
That has nothing. I don't see where that enters into the picture. Nobody in Congress is going to get fired up because of that.
Right.
Now, if it's, we're going to start restricting political content, that's something
that
very
will fire
different.
Up the politicians. Yeah.
Brandon, I used Facebook for the first time the last 2 weeks in probably 2 years, where I listed two free items in our basement on Facebook Marketplace, a weight set and a big sectional couch. Just put it as free. Just somebody come get this. It took 2 weeks to get somebody who said they were going to come to actually come and
really?
Get the free stuff.
Wow.
Then we had the people who showed up who didn't have a truck. We had the person who said, you know, I've got a Toyota Camry. Can we strap this? It's a three sectional couch, you moron. No.
Oh,
you can't. Facebook can go away and I would be completely
you would
fine.
You would be fine. Yeah, you don't.
Do you think this was a hack? Do you think this was?
I wonder. Yeah. wonder, my first thought was it was something like the Anonymous, you know, organization hacking into Facebook, because the proximity to the interview and the revelation seems to just be more than coincidental. It's hard for me to believe that it had nothing to do with what we learned. I mean, because it does seem like it's retaliatory.
I think Facebook is saying this was a DNS configuration gone terribly wrong. Basically, you have all these routers that talk to each other, and there's entries that says, hey, when they say this, go over there.
Right.
Somebody messed that configuration up. I don't think that washes for an 8-hour global outage.
No.
That doesn't
pass the smell test. I mean, because when was the last time Facebook had an outage of this extent? I can't even recall. Yeah.
And Facebook was, I believe, one of the first companies that really pioneered kind of rolling software updates to where, again, you section off your network and your user base. So if you do screw the pooch, you don't bring everybody down.
Right.
And you know this from working where we used to work.
Yeah.
You can't store American citizens' data offshore.
No.
So each country, each geographic area almost has to have its own separate infrastructure. So what happened? Because I think this was a global outage. What configuration happened that brought the whole thing down?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound right.
Something's off there. And again, like you said, without knowing all the details, it just seems fishy.
Brandon, we're making you king of the United States. We have granted you sovereign power from whatever god anybody prays to. You're the old school monarch of the United States.
Okay.
What do we do with social media? In broad-based terms, what do we do?
Are you going to throw that at me? That's like
I always like, you know, taking these huge complicated things, not telling you I'm going to ask you this question and then, you know, putting you on the spot.
Right. Well, I think you have to at least start, and I do not claim to know what the answer is here, but the start would be having greater disclosure requirements, knowing, you know, operations of these social media giants, how they work, having to file annual disclosures at the very least, and treating them more akin to a specific status of a quasi public private company. Because again, I think the difficulty here is all goes back to whether or not you consider these companies have risen to levels of public entities versus private companies. And the best way to look at them may be looking at them as quasi public private enterprises at this point, because they are large enough to where they depend on enough public infrastructure to function daily. They are private companies, though. They have shareholders. They're not a governmental entity. So you start with disclosure requirements. You look at being able to have independent review boards that have people from outside of these giants who will be tasked with those types of reviews, and also proposing regulations looking at the framework of how they operate, so that the whole operation side of it is taken out, so it's not just them deciding. You know, it's a cross-section of people, different backgrounds. So that might be the way you start. I don't think you can just, you know, wake up tomorrow and say, you know, we're going to completely regulate them and they're going to be public entities now akin to, like, you know, the power station or something like that.
How would they even work? What change would be made? When people say they need to be treated like a utility, I don't even know what that means.
I don't either. It almost would be easier to start with some type of antitrust investigation. If you were to break up Facebook, that's an easier route to go, because you don't have to create a new bureaucracy or get the government involved in all these layers of oversight. You can simply say that they are much too large. They violate existing antitrust law. And so we're going to break them up to provide for more market competition. And then that allows the government to then stay out of it at that point.
Why don't you just make a rule? Facebook can't buy any more companies for 10 years.
There you go.
If you want to make something,
look how aggressive they've been. They've bought so many companies over the past decade. I mean, the extent of what Facebook owns is staggering.
Chris Christie, who was on the Dispatch. It's section 32, right? That's the comment section that causes all the problems. He was talking about that, and he said that should go away. And what he said about that was pretty stupid. But what he said that I thought was smart, and where the conversation should start, Section 32 as a law made sense when Facebook and these companies were first coming online, and this was a fledgling industry, and we didn't know what was going to happen.
They were basically large startups at that point. Yeah.
Now, these are some of the most profitable, biggest, largest reaching entities in the world. Shouldn't we go back and look at things that we said, we're not going to mess with you in this way because we want to give you the room to breathe to grow? Now that you've grown into the 800-pound gorilla, it might be time to look at some of that stuff again.
Right.
His point was Section 32 made sense when social media was first evolving because they didn't have the staff, the resources to be able to act like an editorial board. Now they do.
Yeah.
What it's not unreasonable. I just think that we're headed to this point where we're gonna have to take a look at all of this, because I don't think anybody right now I don't think anybody would deny that social media is probably a net negative across the board
at this point. Yeah. And you have Facebook, which has over 2 billion users worldwide. I mean, they're a behemoth. I mean, so when you're on that scale and you basically just have complete control over operations and content, like, you've kind of gone above and beyond. Like you said, the influence is just astronomical that they have. And I mean, they can literally, their channels of which content flows over literally topple regimes and cause revolutions. And, you know, we saw that first started with the Arab Spring, which was driven a lot by social media. So when you've risen to that point where your communications vehicles can literally, spark revolutions, then, maybe we should take a second look.
Are you on TikTok yet?
I'm not, no. TikTok, that's the other one I left out. I was at Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok with the kids. Yeah.
Fastest platform to 1 billion users, TikTok. Where did TikTok come from?
Has it been has it even been a couple of years? It seems like, I guess it was before the pandemic, but TikTok just blew up. I don't know what happened.
Because I was under the impression, my own personal thoughts were, this market's saturated.
Yeah.
No, nothing's going to gain a foothold. You've got Snapchat, all of this stuff. What's left? TikTok comes along and overnight becomes this $1 billion
Huge.
Or this billion user worldwide platform.
And I'll watch TikTok videos. It's dumb. People send it to me, but I haven't acclimated to it. I'm not going to do another social media.
Did you
thing.
Ever get
I'm
on done. Vine or anything like that?
I never did Vine.
Yeah,
either,
it's just
Vine flamed out. That's right. That was long for a hot minute.
They were like 6 second videos or something.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah, it was shorter.
So I don't know what TikTok's algorithm is, but my TikTok feed is all of short little TV clips of Young Sheldon, The Orville, two shows I've never watched in my life, and then random woodworking videos. So
how long have you been on TikTok?
Oh, since the pandemic. Oh,
okay.
You know, if you're looking for a 30-minute waster, there's nothing better than TikTok. But I'm trying to figure out, how does TikTok think a 51-year-old man, this is the content that I'm here for? Now, that said, I don't really know what content I'm here for anyway,
right.
But it certainly could be better than that. Have we ever figured out, do the Chinese actually own TikTok?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know where we were with that. I mean, that was a whole big controversy a couple of years ago.
Remember when
back.
Trump was going to shut it down?
Yeah. And so that ended up not happening. And they still own enough of it. But I don't know.
Because they tried to get Oracle to buy it.
That's right.
They said no. They tried to get Walmart to buy it. And they're like, nah, we don't want to get in that space. Microsoft turned it down.
They've been turned down by so many. So I don't know if they're still Chinese owned or not. And that's the question too, because there's the whole privacy safeguard issue when you have a adversary like China, because there is no such thing as a private company in China.
No.
Any Chinese company, government has access to their data.
The shift from doing something embarrassing and hoping, God, I hope nobody saw that, to doing something embarrassing and saying, God, I hope somebody videoed that.
Yeah, that's where we are as a society. That's where we're at.
For me, that's social media in a nutshell. When did we make this switch from everything has to go online now? Even moments that make you look like an idiot, people still do it. I don't get it. All right, Brandon, what are you watching, reading, It's been a while since I've talked to you. What have you picked up any new shows, any new books, anything like
that? I did. Well, I don't remember if I talked about, I read Anne Applebaum's book, The Twilight of Democracy.
I heard that's really good.
Which was really good. It's a quick read, highly recommended. I think it's just like, it's under 200 pages. It's like 150, like small book, easy to get through. With her experiences, and she's well-traveled and what she's seen. It is also a book that will scare you when you see just all these pieces put together and how we're at this transformational moment in the world where you have these autocratic movements that are gaining steam and you have democracies that are faltering. And there's a lot of historical parallels going back the last couple hundred years. Really great book. Highly recommend it. And then I just recently watched a series on Netflix called Midnight Mass.
Okay.
Which is good. So it's by the producer director team that did The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix.
Is this a show about Catholics?
Yes. So it takes place in this small town. It's a small island community. We never learn where it is. It's off the coast of the US, so it makes you think it's like Maine. It's this little rock that has like 3,000 people on it. It's a depressed, like poor community. And the priest is this new priest comes to town. He's replacing the older priest who went like on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and he's younger, mysterious, and all of a sudden weird things start happening in the island, and they're trying to grapple with
this
it.
This sounds like a lot better than what I thought it was going to be.
It is a lot better, and that's as much as I will say without giving away some of the spoilers. But some of the common themes are of, you know, common themes that are part of this, you know, cult's influence of the perceptible, you know, how people act in groups, and the idea that people tend to act when they're among a herd or a group of people that they would not act on their own. So a lot of those common themes, really good series, 7 or 8 episodes, highly recommend. It's one of those that there's a lot of just like brainless TV that I'll watch. And then like, oh, it's out of my head. I'm like, okay, well, that was 8 hours of my life. This is something I've thought about and continued to think about and like read articles on like after, because it was so intriguing. Once I got to the end of it, and it's very well done. It's one that will make you think. There clearly is a story arc here that picks up on some classic supernatural horror elements. But there's also a lot of modern day parallels with politics and society. And it's very allegorical, and it's just very well done. And then also, if you've grown up as a Catholic or been a Catholic, you see kind of the ritual manifested too, which is interesting. And again, that's probably as much as I'll say without giving away, but it's a very good. And again, I feel like there's so much cliche and supernatural and horror films and content. So I'm always intrigued when I come across something like this that kind of turns that on its head or is a little bit different.
I have The Dropout, which is a podcast about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos.
Oh, yeah.
They've picked up a season 2, which is covers the trial of Elizabeth Holmes.
Oh, okay. Which is underway right
now. Which is underway.
Yeah.
So massive delay for COVID, finally bring to trial. She's had a child from the time that Theranos folded to the time that she's on trial. And her defense is basically that she suffers from PTSD because of the treatment of her COO, a gentleman named Sonny Balwani. I'm probably getting his name wrong.
Who she was having a relationship
with. Who was also her lover during all of this, that he treated her so badly that she had a case of PTSD and cannot be held responsible for what she did. That's the threat. This is what makes people just roll their freaking eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I get it that this is probably the best defense she
has.
That
they can do,
because what she did was indefensible.
Right.
I'm into this podcast because there's something inside of me that
wants to understand.
Since I've kind of exited out of the software and technology area, man, I want to see this chick go to jail.
Yeah.
Just for everybody who knew. This is horseshit.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to. You could see. We've all been there. And I'm looking for something that kind of shakes that technical entrepreneurial area in saying the goal is not to be an entrepreneur. The goal is to produce something.
Right. And we've all seen that, right? We're on a smaller scale where there's been tolerance of just this kind of braggadocio and just this with no substance behind
it. No substance.
And it continues to just go along and go along. And you wonder, okay, when is the floor going to drop out because there's no there?
And George Shultz, former Secretary of State, was her board. Harry Kissinger was on her board. James Mattis was on the board. She told people that these machines and her technology were being used in the field with the U.S. military. I mean, I'm so excited about this podcast, how it ends. I just want one person to be held accountable for anything they've ever done.
Yeah.
And she seems like just as good a target as anyone.
Well, and then the hope is that like it's a cultural change, right? A paradigm change so that others will be held accountable and that we see this filter down, that this kind of excessive entrepreneurial, I think mindset that allows deceit and misrepresentation and manipulation to flourish. Like it's not just in Theranos, like it's all over, that's too much, and then we need to pull the reins back.
And the realization that everything about this woman is a fraud.
Yeah.
Her voice is not her natural voice.
Oh, that deep voice, because she has that distinctive deep voice. That's not her natural voice. Act. Oh my gosh.
The black turtleneck is a direct ripoff from Jobs. Everything about this woman is a crafted, very meticulously put together image designed to do one thing, get money from investors.
So what I don't understand, like, again, without being inside her mind, is how she thought that this would end. Like, did she really think that, like, she would be able to keep that charade up? Like, eventually the bottom's going to fall out. You have to produce, you have to show. But again, I guess that also points to the fact that, you know, she wasn't thinking about that. And so many don't, right? It's just about keeping it going long enough.
Yeah. I'll be interested to see how this ends, but I think this is something that may have some cultural impact to it as well.
Yeah.
That I'd love to see happen.
Me too.
All right. That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to Two Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at twomeninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at twomeninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at twomeninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.